Thank you. Glad to be here at Austin Recovery. How y'all doing today? Good. I'm an alumni of Austin Recovery. I came here back in 2012. The week before I came here, actually it was 3 weeks before I came here. It was in March of 2012. And I was in an abandoned garage. Sorry, I seem to be all over the place here. I was in an abandoned garage, and I had no electricity. I had no running water. And all that I had going for me was this half bottle of Skol vodka. And I had a little portable radio that I was listening to. And I had no idea how my life had gotten there, you know. And I started pondering that maybe life wasn't worth it anymore. And those thoughts had never entered my mind before. Suicide had never, ever entered my mind as a solution to anything until that day. Because I was at a place where I had never been at before. All my doors had closed. There was nobody there to call anymore. There was nothing I knew that was going to make me be able to get up the next day and be able to get up and buy the next bottle that I needed to survive the next day. And I wasn't sure how I was going to do that. That was March 11th of 2012. The next morning, the fire department came breaking through the door, and they took me to the hospital. I hadn't eaten in a week. And I was pretty close to where I wanted to be. My name's Danny P. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you all for inviting me over tonight. That bottom that I hit, it's crazy because I had hit a lot of bottoms before. I had gone to jail. You know, I had gotten two DUIs. I had been to jail countless times. I had just finished serving a 6-month sentence that year for some stuff that I had done 7 years prior. It just caught up to me. And when I got out of jail, I came up with this resolution to like stop doing what I was doing. But as soon as I got out of jail, my brother picked me up and he had a little bottle of vodka. And the first thing that happened was what happens all the time. I started drinking, and once I start drinking, I don't know what's going to happen. That is just what my issue is. When I take that drink, I'm not sure if that's going to be the end of it or if I might be doing this for the next 6 months or a year. That is the way I drank at the end of my drinking career. I have no control over the first drink. That is what the big book tells me. I have an allergy to this stuff. So when I take this stuff into my body, it does something to me that it doesn't do to other people. You know, I used to go to dinner with these people, right? And they used to, like, order a glass of wine. Like, I'd be on a date, and this girl would order a glass of wine. And I'd be like, "Do you want another glass of wine?" And then she'd tell me something like, "No, I'm okay." And I'd be like, "What? What do you mean you're okay? What's the matter? I didn't understand." Or if you wanted to really piss me off, invite me over to your house and offer me a beer and then open the fridge and show me that you only have three, you know? And I'd be like, "Why the hell are you offering me a beer for?" You know, I was such an alcoholic that I even had that much control. I'd rather not drink than just have that stupid beer, you know, because that's just going to drive me insane, you know? I'm the kind of alcoholic that if you start telling me how much to drink, I'm already getting in a bad mood. You know, I'd go to dinner with one of my ex-wives. I have two of them, by the way. And they tell me, "Make sure you only drink three beers," and I'd already be pissed. You know, I'd already be making that excuse to go to the bathroom and getting me a shot on the way to the bathroom. and coming back and pretending, you know. And that's the story of my life. I cannot drink like a normal person. I didn't understand what a normal person was until I started seeing them once I got sober. You know, because I think that everybody drinks the way I drink. You know, me and my girlfriend went on a cruise, what was it, a year and a half, 2 years ago? And I was thinking, man, everybody's going to be drinking. And, it's, you know, I don't know if I could make it to that. And I found out nobody really drinks, you know. It was all in my head. You know, like not that many people were, I didn't see one drunk person. It's just that I was just hanging out at the wrong places, I guess. I don't know what I was doing. I grew up in El Paso, Texas. Those of you who don't know where El Paso is, it's that little town way at the end of Hell's Hole, Texas, way the hell down there. It should be like part of New Mexico, actually, which is what it should be. I don't know why it's part of Texas. But I grew up there, and, you know, if you're from there, you know that it's a great town. I got an El Paso night out here. El Pasoan, actually, is what they're called. So I went to school. You know, I was a musician early in my life. And, for some reason, I had this love of music. My dad kind of put that in me since I was a kid. But, you know, I grew up in a very religious family. You know, my mom was a Catholic woman, very religious. You know, my mom, I know now, I didn't know it back then, was working the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. But she just wasn't an alcoholic. She was just a very good person. She would donate her time to help the poor people in Juarez, and she would take food to them like twice a week, you know, out of her own money. And I never understood this because I didn't see any profit in it, you know. And so I was always shocked by the fact that how much time she spent helping others. And how she managed to put up with me and my brothers, all of us being alcoholic, and how she managed, you know, to do that. And it's because she was practicing something that I knew nothing about, something that it took me, you know, 35 years to learn, actually 42 years, but I guess the first 9 years don't count. But she was a great woman, and she did everything in her power to teach me the right way of living. I didn't come from a broken home. My dad was an alcoholic, but he was a very nice alcoholic. He was the kind of drunk that when he was drunk, he was friendly. Like, he'd be passing out $20 bills, you know, and I'd be like, oh, dad's drunk. Let's go in, you know, we'd have some party money. And that was the way my dad was. My dad never beat me. My dad never hit me. My dad never yelled at me. I mean, he might have a couple of times when I was a kid, but he, not anything that I was upset about. You know, he was a great father, and I had a great mom. So how did this happen? How did I become the person that I became? Well, that's easy, because I'm an alcoholic. I didn't learn to be an alcoholic. I didn't develop to be an alcoholic. I was born an alcoholic. From the time that I remember, I did everything to extremes. Everything I did too much of. You know, if I ate, I ate until I was stuffed. You know, later on, I found out that if I had sex until I could have sex no more. You know, everything I did it to extremes. And it was the same with my drinking. I never enjoyed the taste of beer. I never enjoyed the aging of scotch, or, you know, the my friends would tell me, oh, man, you got to try the scotch. It's really smooth. Does it get you fucked up? Well, all right. You know, that's all I want. You know, does it get me from here to here? Because that's where I want to be. Okay, well, then let me have some of that. You know, and that's the way it was for me. You know, my idea was, you know, quantity, not quality. You know, I proved that by what I was drinking at the end of my demise. You know, that quality Skol vodka that they sell in a half-gallon bottle. You know, that's some good stuff. It's aged about 3 days, I think. So I started this way of life really quickly. I started drinking heavily when I was in junior high. I was a musician. I was a lead singer for a heavy metal band. And so, you know, we'd play these backyard parties, and there were like these really famous cake parties back then that they'd advertise like 20 kegs for $3. And we'd go and we'd play. And of course, they only had like 2 kegs, you know, but they would say 20. So you would come. So, you know, I was one of those guys that the party was by the keg. You know, I didn't understand these people that were mingling. You know, like, why wouldn't you be here? You know, this is where the spout is, you know. And so I was drinking that way since I was very young. You know, I was an alcoholic before I was old enough to drink. And I'm sure a lot of us were, you know. So I started this way of life. And as I went through high school, you know, I started, you know, getting better at what I was doing. And eventually I started playing club bands when I was still in high school. You know, I was already, you know, playing clubs when I was like a sophomore through my senior year. I was already a pretty developed musician in West Texas. And so I went on the circuit, and, you know, that was really the start of my real big demise in my addiction, you know. I discovered other things. I didn't start doing drugs till after I was 20. That's a long time, I don't know. But, you know, I say that because, you know, I hear in these rooms this guy that started doing crack at 12, and I'm like, man, I don't even compete with these people. But, you know, I started doing drugs when I was 20. And that was mainly cocaine, you know, and we used to call it crank. But it was, I guess, some sort of meth. I don't know what it was. They said we used to snort it, and it burned like hell. I remember that. But that stuff would keep me awake for days. And so I continued that way of life. And, you know, all these things I was doing was hurting everything and everyone around me. Along this path, I don't like to go too much into detail about my relationships, because there were tons of them. You know, I'd bore you if I were to tell you about all the kind of relationships I was in. You know, some of them one night, some of them two nights, some of them 3 weeks, some of them lasted for a long time. You know, not just with her, but with a lot of other girls. But you know, one would stick around for a long time. And along this time, I had 2 daughters that through this whole period, I just totally ignored, you know. It was almost like if they weren't there, you know, and I thought I loved them, and I did, you know. But I really loved my addiction. I really loved drinking, and I loved the life that I was living. And as much as I love my daughter, I wasn't strong enough to give this up for her. And I made excuses, you know. I blame my wife for it. You know, my ex-wife, and I said, you know, but I didn't show up to court, and I lost rights to her, and I just said, my ex-wife's a bitch, you know, and she's keeping me from her. And that was partly true, but the main truth was that I just didn't fight hard enough. I just didn't try hard enough. I got angry, and what do I do when I get angry? I just want to escape. When I lost my daughter, I was 23, and I went on this circuit for a long time, and I lost my pain through that. And this wasn't a professional thing. It was a drunk thing. I didn't go out because, I mean, I kind of did want to make it, I wanted to be famous, but I wanted to be drunk more than I wanted to be famous. That was the story of my life, you know. So I continued on this path. There was no doubt in my mind, guys, that at any of this time that I had a drinking problem. I knew I had a drinking problem when I was 18. People would tell me, man, you shouldn't drink that way. They used to tell me, Dan, you need to slow down. This is at 18, not at 30 or 25, like a normal alcoholic, you know. My drug dealer that would sell me coke, he told me one day, he said, man, you need to slow down. You know, drug dealers don't tell you that, you know. And this guy was kind of a friend, you know, but you know, he was like a drug dealer. And for my drug dealer to tell me that should have opened my eyes, right? But it kind of didn't. I stayed on that path. I graduated from high school, and I managed to do that. I went to college for a few years, but I continued my music. That was my main purpose in life, mainly because I could drink all the time. I could use drugs all the time. I love music, like I said, but not as much as I love that. I can't stress that enough. That was the biggest love in my life. This obsession drove me, you know. I have this physical allergy, but I also have this obsession that drives my mind, you know. I'm constantly thinking of drinking. I'm either thinking about drinking or I'm not thinking about drinking. But it's all about drinking. I could wake up in the morning and I used to say, man, wow, man, I can't get loaded because I got a gig tonight and I can't be all plastered in the first set. So I'm going to slow down. But, man, as soon as I finish that first set, I'm going to start drinking. I'm going to be loaded. I'll be feeling good by the end of the night. And that was my thinking, constantly thinking of when it's going to start. Even if I was trying to control it, it was a means that I thought I was controlling it. But it was controlling me. Do you see that? It always controlled me. I have a friend that says, you know, alcohol is like that bit that they put in the horse's mouth. And it just tells me where to go. And it leads me. Even though I think that I'm the one doing the walking, it's the one that's really controlling me. And it's telling me when I'm going to drink. And it's telling me when I'm not. And it's telling me when I'm going to stop, when I'm not. And I think that it's me controlling it, but it's really not. I had no control. It tells me in the book, the minute I take that first drink, I lose my self-will. I don't know, I could have a great plan. I could say I'm leaving work and I'm going to get to the bar. And you know what, my wife has got dinner ready, so I need to be out by 6. But I get there and I start playing some foosball and some pool. And then I have a couple of beers and then it's 6 o'clock. And then I say, well, you know what, I'll just have another round. And before I know it, it's 2 a.m. And I'm calling my drug dealer and I'm all, hey, man, you got any shit? And I'm wondering in my head, what the hell happened? I was supposed to leave at 6. I used to wake up on Sundays to plan my football day. You know, I'm a Tennessee Titan fan. And so they never show the games on TV, so I have to go to the bar. And so I would go to the bar and I would say, this is the plan today, because I would always screw it up. And I'm going to go to the game and I'm going to order some nachos because I need to eat. Because if I don't eat, and then I'm going to get all dry. And I had this whole game in my head, this whole plan, and it was perfect. And I'm like MacGyver coming up with gadgets and things, you know, for me to make this day work out. And so I take that first drink. But you know what happens? The guy that made the plan is no longer there. Now it's the other guy. That always reminds me of that little thing in the book where it talks about Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. You know, the guy that made this plan, you know, it's the smart guy. You know, the guy that thinks he's got it figured out. But then I take that magic potion and I turn into the other guy that doesn't care. He just wants to drink. He just wants to feel good. He just wants to forget about life. And so, no matter how clever my plan is, no matter how much detail I put into it, or how much work I develop in it, it's not going to work the minute I take that drink. It's out of the picture. That is what my life looks like every single time I drink. The third aspect of this disease is called the spiritual malady. The book says, I'm not just physically and mentally sick, I'm spiritually sick as well. And so, what does this mean, spiritually sick? What does it mean that I'm spiritual? I go to church. I don't know what that means. You know, well, I'll give an example of this. I grew up in church. My mom, like I said, and my family were very religious. You know, I went to catechism. I even taught catechism for a while. I did my first Holy Communion, confirmed, and I did everything I was supposed to do as a good Catholic. And I went to church every Sunday, sometimes really hungover. So I know spirituality. So what the hell are you talking about? That I'm spiritually sick. I'm more spiritual well than you are. What are you talking about? Well, I came to find out that spirituality has nothing to do with my religion or how much I know about Jesus or God or Buddha or as many religious organizations as I want to get my master's in. It has to do with action. It has to do with what I do in my everyday life. I knew everything there was to know about God and about the Bible. I know the Bible very well. And, you know, I grew up in a family where I saw what we were supposed to be doing. The problem was is that I wasn't doing anything. I knew the readings. I knew the lessons. I knew the scripture. I just wasn't following it. And that's kind of what happens in AA. This is kind of what happens in, you know, recovery. Is that we could go to treatment and they could teach us everything we need to know. And I could get a sponsor and he gets me through the 12 steps. And I have this spiritual set of tools laid at my feet. The problem is that when my life gets broken, I don't want to open it up. I don't want to pick it up. I don't want to do what I was taught to do. And that is where I'm spiritually sick. The big book says, when the spiritual malady is overcome, we strain out physically and mentally. Wow, that's awesome. So I could fix the spiritual malady and it's going to fix everything else. That is what the big book's telling us. But as an alcoholic and an addict, that's the last thing I want to do. I want to do everything but the spiritual aspect of this thing. You know? So I try to fix the other two things. And I'll tell you how this works. I could fix this physical allergy by not drinking. It's that simple. Well, it's not that hard. I'm just not going to drink anymore. I'm not going to use anymore. Sounds simple enough, doesn't it? And so a lot of people do that, including myself. You know, I probably did it about 500 times in my lifetime. Then I try to stop. What happens, though, is that I stop and things don't get better. They'll get better for a few days. But then I get irritable, discontented, like the book describes. I'll paint some more colorful metaphors for you. Life sucks. Life loses its flavor. I don't enjoy anything anymore. I don't enjoy playing my guitar. I don't enjoy watching a movie. I don't enjoy being with my girlfriend. I don't enjoy walking in the park. I don't enjoy going to concerts anymore. I don't enjoy anything because I lost the thing in my life that gave me life. That's what happens when I stop, when I try to fix this allergy. And a lot of people live this way all their lives. They're called dry drunks. It's called untreated alcoholism. You see them all the time. They're usually that grumpy old man on the porch yelling at all the cars that are passing by. You know, that's untreated alcoholism. I don't want to be that way. You know, I'm not here to tell you guys to go back to your dick. But if I was going to be that way, I'd rather be drinking, you know, and just die a little bit happy, I guess, or whatever. Which, what probably isn't going to happen anyway, but I'm not going to live that way. So I can't do that. I tried it. Second part of it is I could try to fix this obsession by concentrating on other things. You know what? I'm going to start playing my guitar and I'm going to be the baddest guitar player in the world. And I start practicing and I get really good. And there's only so much of that I could do. I could concentrate on my business or my marriage or my kids. And I'm going to put all my time into my family. That sounds, it sounds like an honorable thing to do, right? I'm going to dedicate my whole life to my kids, my whole life to my family. And that's what I'm going to do. That's going to be my concentration. And that'll keep me from this obsession. And it might work until you get some slow time, until you go to sleep at night, until you're driving on the road and your mind takes over. And then the obsession comes back. And eventually, you're going to be tangled up like some rubber bands and you're going to snap. And that drink or that drug is going to seem like a really good idea. And we're going to do that again. We can't fix these things. We've tried that. That's what we've been trying to fix all our lives. But when the spiritual malady is overcome, we strain out physically and mentally. So we got to fix that. This is what the problem is. This is what the issue is. So we got to fix it. So how do we do that? You know, the third step says, you know, we turn our will and our life over to the care of God. But just what do we mean by that? And just what do we do? There's two questions there. Well, I'm going to explain that to you really quick. It's really easy. What I mean by that is that I got to stop playing God. I got to stop thinking that I have a control over every situation in my life. That if I just push myself hard enough into something, that I'm going to make it better. Because that's what we've been doing all our lives. I think through my self-will that I could do anything. You know, I'll just get that third job. Or I'll just do this. The problem with our plans in that is that I'm just thinking of me. Okay? While I'm getting that third job, I'm neglecting my kids. I'm neglecting my wife. You know, while I'm, you know, all obsessed with my how to get out of this problem, I block everybody out. So the book says selfishness, self-centeredness, that is the root of my problem. And by trying to solve everything through me, I'm only thinking of me and not anybody else. And that's where selfishness dwells. And it spreads like a wildfire. And all of a sudden, it's followed by cons, you know, all kinds of things. The book says selfishness, self-centeredness. This is the root of our problem, followed by a thousand forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking. Self-pity. And all this stuff kills me. It drives me to the ground. So I need to stop doing that. That is what that question means. The second one is just, and what do I do? That's even easier. Well, I take step four. That's what I do. And once I take step four, I get my sponsor and I do my step five. And once I discover who I really am through my fourth step, and I get rid of all this junk that's been blocking me, all this hatred and anger and resentment and fear that's been holding me down, for, in my case, for 42 years of my life, I try to get rid of it. And then I'm able to see my defects, to see what in my life was killing me, what in my life was taking me down. After that, I can make amends to the people that I harmed and then get closer to my higher power that I just found, build a relationship with them. And finally, at the end of it, try to do this work that I'm supposed to do. I have this contract with my higher power. It says, I have a new employer. That would be whoever your higher power is. Being all powerful, he provides what you need if you keep close to him and perform his work well. That is what my job is now. Performing his work means right now, for anybody who's in the steps, means finishing off these steps. It means go through these steps. That is what your job is right now. Don't worry about anything else. Just get these steps done. Things will reveal themselves to you as time comes. When you get to step 12, this is where the magic starts. This is where the happiness starts coming in. Because I like to think that being in the steps, and just because I'm Catholic, so pardon me, but being in the steps is like being in purgatory. You know, I'm not happy. You know, I'm not miserable. But I'm kind of like, you know, I'm in the middle. It's all right. Life's okay. You know, it's not unbearable. I'm not out on the streets, you know, eating out of a garbage can. But, you know, it's not the happiest life I've ever lived. But it's when you finish the steps that life starts bringing you happiness. And it says in working with others, it says, practical experience shows that nothing will so much ensure immunity from drinking as intense work with other alcoholics. It works when other activities fail. This is the 12th step in our recovery. Carry this message to other alcoholics. You can help when no one else can. You can secure their confidence when others fail. Remember, they are very ill. Life will take on new meaning. To watch people recover, to see them help others, to watch loneliness vanish, to see a fellowship grow up about you, to have a host of friends. This is an experience you must not miss. We know you will not want to miss it. Frequent contact with a newcomer and with each other is the bright spot of our lives. That is what we're shooting for. That is where I want to be. Doesn't that sound awesome? That is the feast. That is the feast, the table that's ready for you. You know, I heard something in church today. I'm going to change it around a little bit, but it says, you know, everybody's welcome, but not everybody gets it. And that's sad. But there's no need why you can't get it. Problem is that we're human. My sponsor reminds me of that every day. He says, you know what your problem is that you'll never rise above human, Danny. You know? So that's why you need to keep working these steps. I'm always going to get caught into my old ideas. Excuse me. I'm always going to think of myself, regardless of how many times I work these steps. No matter how many sponsors I have. No matter how many miles I go down the road, you know. I heard a newcomer tell me, you know, it doesn't matter how many, you know, the years are like milestones on the highway. And no matter how many miles you have, you know, the gutter's only 3 feet away. And that's true. You know, it doesn't matter how much I work this program. What matters is that I continue to do what's in this program. I'm never cured from alcoholism. What I have is a daily reprieve contingent on the condition of my spirituality. How spiritual I am. Where I'm at. Am I working with other sponsees? You know what? Am I really doing the right thing at meetings? Am I at meetings to go outside and smoke cigarettes and drink coffee? Or am I there to meet the newcomer? Am I there to say hi to that guy that really needs help? And go, hey man, welcome, sit down. Can I get you some coffee? Can I do this for you? Show me what I could do for you. Do you have a sponsor? If you don't have one, man, I'll sponsor you. And if he tells you, man, well, I'm not sure. Well, you know what? I'll be your sponsor till you get one. Shoot for that. Because that is where the happiness comes. I see a lot of people at meetings, guys, sitting down, listening. They might have 8 years there. And they're doing the meeting thing, the meeting shuffle. But they're not working the program. The program is in the 12th step. In the third step, they kind of go together. And I got to turn my will over to God every day. And I got to turn my attention to someone I can help every day. If I don't try to do this every day, eventually things start kind of falling down. It's real easy for me to start forgetting. I have two commitments that I do every week that I've been doing since I got sober. One of them is that I come back here every Monday evening at 7 o'clock. And we kind of teach a little step class, me and a couple of other guys. I've been doing that for 4.5 years. The other thing I do is that I go to a halfway house called the Austin Transitional Center every Thursday. Chris spoke in there for a few years ago, I think. You need to come back, by the way. Putting him on the spot. And those commitments have saved my life, guys. I kept on them. And don't think I'm a saint. You know, we're not saints. The book says that. You know, there's not one Monday that I get back from work and I'm not saying, God, I got to go to the yard today. Bitch. Oh, you know, I start watching TV and I take my boots off and I'm like, man, why can't I just stay here and just watch TV, man? I just worked 8 hours in the hot sun. Why do I got to drive all the way to freaking Buda to go help these guys that aren't even going to remember me next week? And then I say, oh, because I'm an alcoholic. And that's what I got to do. And it's not easy, guys. It's simple. It's not easy. You know, I'm not going to say that every Monday when I get off work, I'm like, yeah, it's Monday. I get to go to AR. Yeah, woo. The first 3 weeks were like that. And then after the first year, it started kind of dwindling. And then after the third year, you're just like a zombie. You know, just kind of getting there. But you know what? I'm standing here sober in front of you. More than that, guys, I'm standing here joyous, full of life, and free for the first time in my life. I'm not going to tell you life doesn't, pardon my language, doesn't kick me in the nuts every once in a while. It does. It does all the time. So that's what life does. You know, that's life's job. Life wouldn't be doing its job if it was just nice and easy. Then we'd be dead. We'd be in heaven, I guess. You know, but you know, that's what they call it life. You know, it's a weird thing. It's old. I heard this 6 months into my recovery. This gentleman that's no longer with us, he said, I'm not sure if God ain't going to put on my plate more than I can't handle. I'm not sure if that saying is true from my experiences. But I know for sure that life is going to throw at me more than I can handle. I know that. Because it's been doing that to me every single day of my life. And if I don't have God in my life, it's going to be a long run. It's going to be a long ride. So I have to take the spirituality aspect of it. If you have trouble with the spiritual aspect of this, fine. I'm not trying to shove God down your throat. I'm not trying to shove my religion down your throat. Definitely not trying to shove AA down your throat. What I am trying to tell you is that there are two options here. The book talks about this. We could go on this way of our miserable existence until the end of my miserable existence. The way we've been doing. That road is there. It's set. I always disagree with that part of the book. I don't even think that's an option. That road is already there. Or I could accept spiritual help. And there's nothing in the 12 steps, guys. I'm trying to look for them, but they're not here. There's nothing in the 12 steps that says you got to understand this. Nothing. There's no step that says, oh, and you got to understand why these things work. No. They're just suggestions that millions of alcoholics have taken that have worked for them. And they're telling you, if you do this, rarely have we seen a person fail. My sponsor is an atheist. He was an atheist. His daughter died of addiction, who was pissed at life, who hated AA, hated sober people, and hated everybody telling him that it was his only way. And he came into the program saying, I'm going to go in this thing doing everything exactly the way you tell me to do it. Just to prove to you, bunch of whatever, I'm not going to repeat what he said, that you're wrong. That this doesn't work. That this is just a big lie to get money from you and to do this and to do that. The money thing sounds kind of silly, but yeah. Yeah, we make a fortune here. And that was his willingness, okay? This is what I'm telling you about willingness. That was his willingness. I'm there to prove this wrong. My sponsor's been sober 16 years. And he believes in something. He doesn't call it God. But he says, I don't know what's out there, Danny, but there's definitely something out there. It wasn't 12 little rules on the wall that got me sober. And if he could go in with that amount of faith, imagine what your amount of faith could do. Doesn't matter what that is. It could be scooting over from here to here.
Okay.
Have faith to take the next step. Say, you know what? I'm not sure what I believe, man. I'm not sure. You know, I don't believe in any of that God thing, but you know what? Sure, I'll take the fourth step. Let's see what happens. And when you take your fourth step, maybe you'll be willing to take your fifth step. But always have in mind that all these people that are talking to you have been where you were. And that what they're telling you has to be true. If I was miserable, guys, and I hated this, and I was just, why would I be up here? You know, why would any of us be here trying to convince you of this big lie? I'm here because I found an awesome way of life. I tapped into something that was better than gold. And when I got that, I wanted more. And so I kept drilling. I came to AA with a little bit of broken faith. A lot of knowledge about faith. A little bit of broken faith. Thinking I knew everything about faith. I was the guy that would get in fist fights at bars over Jesus Christ. You know? Come on, what's better than that? Right? I believed. I was walking the wrong path. But I found something in here. I came into AA, and AA made me discover faith again. I didn't come to AA to find God, but it was through AA that I did. It was through AA that I went back to church. It was through AA that I found the love of my life. It was through AA that everything happened. And so I have to keep coming back. You know, this is my substitution for my drinking. This is my substitution for my addiction. I can't just find something else and leave this. I'm an alcoholic first and foremost. You know, yes, I'm a Catholic and I go to church, but I can't count on that to keep me sober. It never had. And I've known a lot of people that have done that. Don't do that. I'm not telling you not to go to church. Don't say, Daddy said not to go to church. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying, find your calling. Go. Get spiritual. Learn the Bible. It's a great book. Learn the teachings of your higher power, whatever that might be. You know, learn more about it. If that's what's calling to you, do it. It called to me. After AA, I wanted more, so I pursued it. But never leaving my commitments, never leaving my meetings, never leaving my fellowship. Sure as hell, never not sponsoring, not carrying this message. And let me make something clear, guys, and I'm going to close up. Carrying the message doesn't mean to go help a lady across the street. Or to open the door for a gentleman. I'm doing service work, you know. It means that we need to help other alcoholics. We need to carry this message to other alcoholics. Because God's message, and Blind Dave said it perfect the other day, says there's better people than that, than us, you know. We know this. We live this. We owned this. So who the hell's better than us to carry this message to other people? Only an alcoholic could help another alcoholic. Go out there and do the service work. That's what's going to keep you sober. You keep doing that. You keep taking inventory. And you keep trusting in God. And I guarantee you, you'll stay sober every day of your life. I'm going to close with this, guys. My friend had emphasized the absolute necessity of demonstrating these principles in all our affairs. Particularly was it imperative to work with others as he had worked with me. Faith without work was dead, he said. And how appallingly true. For even alcoholic, failed to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others. He could not survive the certain trials and low spots ahead. If he did not work, he would surely drink again. And if he drank, he would surely die. Then faith would be dead. With us, it is just like that. My name is Danny Posadas. I'm an alcoholic. May God bless you and keep you. Thank you.